This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we call the show Main Street because our microphones make a virtual Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. The real ones are very important to where we live. They're sort of where we meet each other, talk about our news and opinions, share, you know, what's on our minds. And today, we have the great pleasure of talking with Adam Gaylor. He is the Jamestown High School principal, and more importantly, a week ago Tuesday, he was the announced winner of a Milken Educator Award, and he joins us by phone from Jamestown. Thanks for being with us, Adam.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
Well, this happened on Tuesday, November 21st. Were you surprised?
Yeah, I mean, it was a complete shock. I guess the ruse was that we were hosting a celebration of innovation for our school, which I still believe that it was. But that we were hosting some dignitaries for that, and that Kirsten Basler was going to address our students in an assembly, and so she did do that, and I did my part of introducing, and then preparing some comments to kind of close out the ceremony. But after she had spoken to the students, then a different person that I didn't know grabbed the microphone and started in talking about what the Milken Award is, and just education and appreciation for education in general. And so I was thinking to myself, well, which one of our teachers, because we've got some hardworking staff here, which one of our teachers is going to get that award? And then, quite shocked, I guess, that I was the recipient of it, and a little bit overwhelmed and surprised all at the same time. But it's quite an honor to be recognized that way, and I think I represent a lot of educators that work really hard.
Well, there are only 30 or 40 of these educator awards given out by the Milken Foundation each year, so this is an extraordinary compliment to you. The last time I think one was given out in North Dakota was about 2009, several years ago at any rate. So tell us about your journey. You're a young educational leader. How'd you get to where you are?
Sure. So I guess, I had a set of circumstances in life that kind of put me on a path to teaching deployed with Army National Guard out of Jamestown after my first year of college, which was less focused than I wanted it to be, and came back from that experience and said, after seeing some of the worst of what humans can do to each other, I wanted a profession that gave me hope for the best, and that was really education for me. And I came back and dove into that. I had some great professors at North Dakota State University, and then was about set to student teach and got deployed again for a second deployment in Iraq. And I think those were really formative experiences for me, both from a leadership perspective and obviously just from an outlook perspective on what it was that I wanted to be able to do and achieve with others in my life. And so I started my teaching actually at the STEM Center Middle School in West Fargo, and that was a middle school that was focused on science, technology, engineering, and math, but really we had an opportunity to kind of re-envision education, and I was fresh out of college with lots of great ideas and a great team to support me, and leaders that in West Fargo that inspired me, and was able to, after a few years of teaching there, then move up into a leadership position. I started my master's degree with Tri-College, which is NDSU and Morehead State and Concordia for education leadership, and moved into an administrative position at West Fargo High School, and then moved over to Cheney Middle School as activities director and assistant principal there. And then this is my second year now in Jamestown as the head principal here.
Well, for our listeners, the Milken Educator Awards has this kind of description. There is no nomination process to be considered for the Milken Educator Award. Candidates are confidentially recommended to the foundation by a blue ribbon panel appointed by each state's Department of Education. So, obviously, the Superintendent of Public Instruction was very supportive of this nomination.
Yeah, certainly. When Kirsten Basler spoke at the presentation, she had said that you know, she met me 6 years ago, which is true. We've met at the STEM Center Middle School in West Fargo, and had a good discussion about innovation and education and just what are the big rocks we put first in that. And she was kind of coming to observe and see our school in action and you know, get a feeling for the culture and the types of work that we were engaging students in.
What does the award mean to you? It's $25,000 without any strings attached.
Yeah, that's quite an honor. It's a shock. I think, you know, again, a lot of educators work really hard, and so that nobody goes into education for the money in it. At least I don't believe that. And so, you know, to be surprised with that is excellent. It is a, you know, of course, a taxable award, and I've got some students that are great leaders in the school too, who are helping me think of ideas, ways we can multiply a portion of that for our school, and then you know I think I want to invest a little bit in either in my own kids' learning or in my own learning, pursuing a doctorate with some of that as well. And it's an exciting opportunity. I haven't made any concrete decisions yet, but I plan to put it towards learning no matter what, because that's what my mission is.
Well, I Googled you, went online, and listened to your 2013 TEDx Fargo talk, which began with, "How will you impact the world?" So you like to share the idea of educational change.
Of course, yeah. I think, again, I've had a fortunate set of circumstances and a lot of hard work and a lot of continuous learning to the point where I've been able to provide some leadership and insight on research and both promising practices as well as best practices within education. I've been able to give some great presentations to great audiences. That was one of them. You know, TEDx is really all about inspiration. I draw a lot of inspiration from TED Talks and TEDx Talks, and to have that opportunity in Fargo meant a lot, and I felt like my message would still ring true with what I believe today, which is that you know, students learn best by doing, and we need to get to that application level. There's obviously some foundational pieces that underpin that, and that when students are truly authentically engaged in something, they learn so much more, they're so much more reflective, and they're doing it not just for themselves and their own improvement, but in ways that actually can impact their community and their world.
Well, for our listeners, what have you learned about effective educational practices that should be broadly implemented?
Certainly, you know, there, as with anything, there's no silver bullet, and you know, what I, the message that I really want to send is that you have to be engaged in both those best practices and promising practices because our kids are changing, our world is changing, education is increasingly complex, and I believe that we need to equip teachers with a variety of strategies, tools in their tool belt, if you will, that allow them to pick what, you know, allow them to align to the outcomes of the state standards and say, you know, here's the outcome we have. Now, what tool and technique will best help me bring that to our students? And that varies from community to community, and it varies from school to school. Some of the big things that we focus on are, you know, just solid assessment and instructional practices, and then some practices like project-based learning or design-focused learning, which is really about STEM education, science, technology, engineering, math, where if you're designing something, and the world around us, of course, is, for the most part, designed, if you're designing something, you're really integrating a lot of disciplines into that, and you need to have such mastery of the content that you can express that through your design. And so it's really an opportunity to evaluate and synthesize and analyze. It's good critical thinking, I guess, the design process is. And so we try to encourage that where it's the best fit for the type of target or standard that the teacher is trying to meet. And then, of course, there's all sorts of focus now on how can we continue to personalize in education? How do we customize and advance students more at their own pace, whether that's an accelerated pace or whether that's a pace where we need to support and fill in gaps in their previous learning?
Is it time to rethink the time that students spend at individual grade levels? I mean, should students advance at their own pace or at the pace of their peers?
Certainly. There's a number of schools around the nation that are experimenting with the concept of competency-based, where students do advance at their own pace. And I believe that, you know, technology has put us in a place where we can better track student learning to be able to do that, when we can set things up so that students can move at their own pace. But then I believe that there's also a place for common experiences with students through projects. I believe that there's a place for bringing every student in a community together in a public space and working on the social, emotional, and citizenship aspects that we bring to school. And so I think it's a blend. And again, just like I had said have said many times with our teachers, it's not about one tool or another. It's about having the right set of tools in your tool belt for when the strategy matches the outcome that you want for your kids. So personalized learning, advancing students at their own pace, I think will work for some outcomes that we want in education, but it won't work for all of them that we need for our kids and for their future.
What do you do for students who struggle?
Certainly, both in West Fargo and in Jamestown, we've developed a tiered system of support, and that's for both students who struggle and for our advanced students. We want to make sure that we're analyzing data and making database decisions in order to get students in courses that are just the right fit for them. Beyond that, what we're doing in our professional learning communities, which is where our teachers meet together to plan curriculum and to plan assessment, but also to plan what do we do if a student comes to us already knowing something, and what do we do if a student comes to us not knowing something. So, again, the personalization is by student, by skill, and that's something that we're working towards really to provide our students with that are struggling, and our other students that have already maybe met a standard or have an understanding of something. How do we enrich those students?
Well, I remember, and I imagine many of our listeners remember, being in a classroom where a teacher was in the front talking to us, and occasionally we go to a workbook. It was sort of rote learning or, you know, get this assignment done kind of thing. Has the look or layout of classrooms changed to accommodate new teaching techniques?
Yeah, I think that varies across our schools. And, again, it depends on the target that you're trying to reach with those students. Sometimes that direct instruction model, although probably not the same model that you had where someone was just presenting for a long period of time and then here's your assignment. Our direct instruction is much more focused where we're using strategies that engage students in the process, where everybody is doing everything, and having meaningful research-based direct instruction. I think that still has a place in our classrooms for certain types of skills. And then we also need the spaces which you're, I think, alluding to as well, which is where students are applying their own creativity and critical thinking and working in teams, and the teacher is more of the facilitator of learning and has done the majority of their work in planning and setting up an authentic situation for students to tackle a problem, to apply their skills and knowledge that they've learned. And that's a beautiful thing to see, too. It's a totally different feeling where there's kind of that busy hum of learning in a classroom, rather than one person imparting all the knowledge. And we know that our students have access to many more resources than just that teacher in front of them now. And so it's more about how do we teach them to be media literate, how do we teach them to validate their resources that they're using, and teaching them to learn how they learn best as well, really to use their own mind well.
All right. Well, congratulations on the Milken Educator Award, Adam Gaylor, Jamestown High School principal. That's quite an honor.
Yes, indeed. Thank you.
Coming up, we'll hear from another Jamestown educator. He's retired, but he's Bruce Berg.
The Minot Chamber Chorale is celebrating the 45th anniversary of the Renaissance Christmas Feast. Lord Eric, Lady Pamela, and the Royal Court invite you to join in the laughter and fun as they ring in the 2017 Christmas season with lots of skits and music. Doors open at 6. Performance begins at 7. Guests at the feast can grab some wassail and prepare to go back in time to 1517. Tickets available by phone at 701-441-3094.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Bruce Berg taught English in Jamestown for many years before retiring. He still practices his craft with commentaries he shares with us on Main Street. And today, Bruce shares his thoughts about one of his favorite places in a piece titled Jamestown College to the University of Jamestown.
Not long ago, I talked with a Jamestown doctor who called Chicago home. He waxed enthusiastically about an important part of this Buffalo City of Jamestown. He said he was quite amazed that a town the size of Jamestown could house such an impressive institution as the University of Jamestown, known to most in this last century as Jamestown College. I did not disagree. After some starts and stops in the late 19th century, this private, somewhat Presbyterian college got its academic legs moving in 1909 under the leadership of Baron Kruse, who stayed at the Jamestown College helm until 1946. The college was located just north of this railroad town on what the Indians called Hiacan, or the Windy Hill. Photos taken of the hill in the 1920s from an airplane show a few buildings located on a rather colorless hill, bleak and treeless. Photos today would show a school with coordinated colors of the campus structures, surrounded by trees enough to give the school, well, very much a New England look. It's been said by many that one of the best ways to recruit new students to Jamestown College, University of Jamestown, is to encourage a walk through the university grounds and let the possible new members of the school drink in the sheer beauty of a college that looks the way a college should look. The school changed its name to the University of Jamestown when it expanded its curriculum and added a physical therapy building in Fargo. Any school needs leadership, and the approach to education from the years of Dr. Kruse to the current president, Robert Bedall, is different. The needs of the present day and yesteryear are apart. The culture, the students, the faculty are different from the days of Kruse, but the need for effective leadership hasn't changed, and I suspect that the Jamestown College president of the early century would celebrate the direction forged by Robert Bedall. Jamestown has been well served by its small but dynamic university, and someday, if you're in the area, UJ would invite you to stop off and take a wander on Hiacan, where the wind still blows, but in celebration of an educational institution that has the look of dedication, quality architecture, and the feel that this is a hill that has grown and prospered and served thousands of students who are most proud to talk about their college, their university, the University of Jamestown. This is Bruce Berg, Jamestown.
Next on Main Street, Harvest Public Media reports about clean water in farm country.
My father sold the ranch in Wyoming. It had been home to my family for almost 100 years. This ranch had survived the Indian Wars and the Great Depression, but it could not survive the death of my grandfather.
Join us for stories from the National Cowboy Poetry Gathering next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. It's not cheap to treat water that's been polluted by farm runoff, and cities surrounded by farmland are concerned the cost is going to keep increasing. Des Moines, Iowa, tried to strengthen the Federal Clean Water Act by forcing more regulations on farmers, but its plan didn't work, and the Trump administration has rolled back some rules and may have more easing in mind. One of the issues at a recent Des Moines City Council meeting dealt with water quality. And for Harvest Public Media, Clay Masters reports from Des Moines.
Voters here have questions about the city's source water, which has had high levels of nitrates that, untreated, can be harmful to infants and pregnant women. Voters are asking candidates like Michael Kiernan,
is it safe to drink, safe to consume?
Nitrates occur naturally, but are also a byproduct of nitrogen fertilizer that farmers put on their fields by the ton. The Des Moines Water Works spent more than $2 million over 2 years cleaning the river water it uses for its half-million customers. The utility sued drainage districts in upstream farm counties, a lawsuit that could have changed the face of farming in the upper Midwest. But a federal judge said any regulations must come from the state legislature. It shouldn't be a political issue, says city council candidate Abshir Omar, who has a firsthand experience with living with contaminated water. He's a Somali refugee who also lived in a refugee camp in Kenya.
And for us to live in the wealthiest nation in the history of the world, the most technologically advanced society on planet Earth, that we have to fight for clean water, I think that's a shame.
The deck is stacked against cities like Des Moines, says Mark Ryan, an attorney who spent 2 decades with the EPA.
Cities are not in the driver's seat on this. They're being driven.
Ryan, speaking via Skype, says because farm runoff is not regulated, cities have to spend a lot of money cleaning up water. And there are examples from the Chesapeake Bay in the Northeast to Boise, Idaho.
Litigation usually doesn't benefit many people, but sometimes that's the only thing left. But I think we're going to have to get creative if we want to solve the long-term problem of ag runoff.
One solution is having farmers change the way they manage their land and how they apply fertilizer to keep nitrates from going downstream. And right now, that's just voluntary. Tembar Dole farms more than 2,000 acres in north-central Iowa's Greene County and serves on the board of the Iowa Soybean Association. He says the Des Moines Waterworks lawsuit left many farmers out here mad.
It gets more anger and emotion into a problem, which makes it very hard to solve or improve on the problem.
Bardole farms with his father, brother, and son. They've changed how they do things to help address various issues, such as planting 1,500 acres of cover crops this year. That's a way to keep more of the nitrate in the soil and out of waterways. Tim's son, Skyler, says cover crops cost a lot.
But we see it as the best thing to do for the soil, for the environment, and just the longevity of the farm itself and the ground. And when it comes down to it, too, I mean, we drink water, too.
The state of Iowa and farm lobbyist groups don't want to put more regulations on farmers. But that's not good enough for the Des Moines Water Works. The utility's general manager, Bill Stowe, says the lawsuit may have been dismissed, but they won't back down.
Our responsibility really requires us to stand up into a headwind, even when that headwind is not just industrial producers, polluters, if you will, but the national and state governments themselves.
U.S. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue recently signaled the Trump administration wants to eliminate more regulations for farmers, but he did not specify what those might be. And U.S. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt says his agency is in the process of redefining water regulations and believes in traditional oversight from states. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Clay Masters in Des Moines.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that looks into America's farm and rural issues. Coming up on Main Street, Chuck Lura will have a natural North Dakota essay. Chef Rosie will join Ashley Thornburg and me to talk about food. It's lima beans this time. Then we'll share our What's Happening calendar of events. First, the news with Danielle.
The state for Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The State Board of Higher Education is on record asking that it needs to have representation on the governor's task force on higher education governance. That task force will begin its meetings in December. Board member Casey Ryan.
There needs to be some connection from the higher ed board on this group so that they understand what is already being done, because you have a very, no doubt, diverse group being selected, and they may have a lot of ideas, but they may not realize that, well, that's been going on for 10 years. So yep. We need to have some representation, whether voting or just listening or being there as a resource to this body.
Today is the last day to apply to be on that task force. Three members of the board have said they already have applied to be on it. Meanwhile, Higher Ed Board Chairman Don Morton wanted to clarify what he called some misunderstandings about the task force.
This is not a task force to look at closing campuses. Matter of fact, he raised a question that maybe we need more points of delivery of knowledge. So it's not about closing campuses, it's about governance.
Morton says he doesn't know how Governor Burgum will choose the task force members. Farms across the U.S. are expected to make more money in 2017 after three straight years of falling income. But Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports not all farmers will have fatter pocketbooks.
Farm income is expected to rise by about 3% nationwide this year, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. That's because of higher prices for dairy, pork, and poultry. At the same time, the USDA says farmers who grow wheat, corn, or soybeans will see another year of declining income. Tim Cook, the chief credit officer for Farm Credit Services of America, says an oversupply of those crops is keeping prices down.
For most producers, those current price levels are below what their cost of production are.
Some parts of the country have a better outlook based on their dominant product. For example, corn is a drag on farms in the northern plains and Midwest, but cattle and cotton are leading a rebound in the southern plains. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
And Hillsboro, North Dakota, is about to do away with its police department. The city is expected to approve a contract with Trail County for law enforcement coverage in the city on Monday night. Sheriff Steve Hunt says Police Chief Ray Weber will join his department.
The city lost their second officer back in end of June, first part of July, I think, so it's been just the chief since then. And so the city was looking for other options rather than to keep hiring and training and losing people. So they've asked the county if we were willing to contract, and we took a look at it, and it looks like something we can probably do.
Hunt says with Chief Weber and the planned hiring of another deputy, his department would have 10 sworn officers. The city will pay the county about $174,000 in the first year of the contract. The county will also provide Mayville with police services. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Won't you be our neighbor? Prairie Public is partnering with Gate City Bank and Cambrian Credit Union to help keep all of our neighbors warm with the Mr. Rogers Neighborhood Sweater Drive. Now through December 15th, drop off new or gently worn sweaters at any Gate City Bank in North Dakota and Western Minnesota, or any Cambrian Credit Union in Manitoba. Your gift will be distributed to folks in those communities who are in need of a little extra warmth. For more information, visit prairiepublic.org.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor.
Thank you for being a good neighbor.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. Chuck Lura is a Main Street regular, and he's heard at other times on Prairie Public as well. Chuck is the author and voice of Natural North Dakota, a series of essays about the animal and plant life and natural phenomena where we live. Today, his subject is hawthorn trees.
While walking through the Turtle Mountain Aspen Forest recently, I noticed a hawthorn tree with a heavy fruit set. I lingered around the tree to see if a rough grouse would flush nearby, but to no avail. Most grouse hunters will often thoroughly check around these trees because the fruits are utilized by grouse, particularly once the winter snows arrive. Hawthorns, sometimes known as thorn apples or haw, are members of the rose family. They're native to temperate zones of North America, Europe, Asia, and North Africa. The genus to which they belong, Cretigus, is extremely variable. This has been a difficult group for plant taxonomists. They hybridize profusely, many differ in the number of sets of chromosomes, and some can even produce fruit and seeds without fertilization, a phenomenon called apomixis. Hawthorns are highly variable, densely branched, small-spreading trees or shrubs with stout, sharp thorns, 1 to 2 inches long. The leaves are alternate, entire or lobed, with glandular-tipped toothed margins, and the flowers are generally about a half inch in diameter with 5 showy white petals. The fruits of hawthorn are often resembling small apples, about a half an inch in diameter. There are probably 3 species native to North Dakota. They're widely distributed across the state, although they are perhaps most commonly observed in the Turtle Mountains, Pembina Hills, and Kildare Mountains. I've also noticed them frequently on the Missouri Coteau. For example, most of the woody thickets observed while driving Highway 3 from south of Harvey to north of Steele are dominated by hawthorn. The edibility of the fruits of hawthorn is quite variable, but they are edible if you use the term loosely. Yule Gibbons, in his Stalking the Healthful Herbs from 1966, colorfully described the variability when he quoted an 11-year-old girl that described hawthorn as, and I quote here, "When they are good, they are not very good, and when they are bad, they're horrid." Unquote. But if you sample several hawthorns and find one that tickles your taste buds, you might try to make some jam or jelly from them. I've even heard of a compote made from them along with highbush cranberry. But perhaps we should just leave the fruits to the rough grouse and other birds that apparently find the fruits much more to their liking. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
You've heard it. You know it. It's a key part of surf culture.
I grew up at the beach, and I grew up surfing. And one of the terms that we would use for waves when it was, like, big and stormy is the word gnarly. My hands were all gnarled, and, you know, I invented the word gnarly, and that's how it came to be.
Join us this week on Away With Words.
Oh, I hate to be nebby about that.
Saturday morning at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and Chef Rosie. And Ashley, this week we're talking about beans, right?
Beans, yes. Lima beans, Lima beans. They're from Lima. We say Lima. What's the deal?
Well, you know, whether we call them Lima beans or Lima beans, or we call them Great Northern beans, or we call them white beans, or we call them Anastasia beans, or we call them Gigante beans, many different names, many different varieties, all come back to that little white stomach-shaped bean that has a wonderful protein texture and is very good for you. And most importantly, it has this buttery flavor. And that's the reason it came with the name that I like the most is the butter bean.
You had me at butter.
So this goes back a ways. People have been playing with butter beans, lima beans, lima beans for a while.
You know, they come from Lima, Peru, as far back as 6,000 BC. But then there are other people that say from Guatemala from 1500 AD. But whether it's 1500 AD or 6,000 BC, a long time ago. And the cool thing about this particular bean, it is a perennial bean. And of all the thousands of varieties of beans, it's one of the only beans that can be grown almost anywhere in this country. It's a bean that the only major growing statistic about it is it must be germinated in soil that's above 65 degrees. And some people even say 70 degrees. So not so good for the Midwest, North Dakota area.
They'd have to get going kind of late in the growing season.
Sounds like a California crop, huh?
It is, you know, and right now most of the crop that we get, it comes from Central America, Mexico, and South America.
What's so good about them?
Well, first and foremost, I'll have to repeat myself, but it's the buttery texture. And one of the things that I challenge people to do is if you have a cabinet full of assorted varieties of beans, and whether it's black beans, red beans, kidney beans, white beans, you need to sometime buy the dried bean, especially this lima bean, and soak it for 6 hours or overnight, but it does need that soaking. The only way around the soaking process is a pressure cooker. And if you use a pressure cooker, yes, you can make those beans in an hour. But otherwise, be leery of thinking that you can put a lima bean on the stove in water, and then just I'll simmer it slowly overnight because tomorrow morning you'll still have a hard lima bean, and that's not going to change. They need to be slow soaked. And back to this buttery texture I referred to, that buttery texture is a wonderful addition to use in place of roux and making soups. It's a great thickening agent. And once you taste beans that have just been soaked overnight, simmered in water and finished with salt and pepper and butter, you'll realize that that texture and flavor is just amazing. And try it next to the canned bean, whatever type bean you have in your kitchen shelf, and you will be sold forever to always use dried or for those few times a year that we can get the product, the bean fresh. They are amazing fresh, but I will caution you to say that they are not a bean that you should eat raw. There's some people that say that they can be toxic or poisonous, but they're not to be eaten raw ever.
Well, you mentioned this preparation technique, because I'm one of those people who just goes and buys a can of beans, different kinds of beans, mix them all together, I've got chili all of a sudden. But if I buy them dry, they last for a long time, I can decide how much I want to cook at any one time, and they taste better?
The texture is better, the taste is better, the flavor is better, so it's a win-win-win.
And it might even be less expensive to buy them dry.
Most certainly less expensive. And when you look at shelf life, you know, I couldn't find anywhere that showed how long a dried bean can stay in your shelf. But if it's in a sealed container and there aren't bugs or light or humidity on the product, I'm thinking years and years and years.
So if I can find 6 hours at least to put my beans in water,
you know, I'm better off.
Or, right before you go to bed.
Yeah.
Or a pressure cooker.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah.
And that works. That's equipment.
Yeah, right. That's a piece of equipment.
Can you soak them in things besides water? I feel like one time I was just experimenting, and it wasn't specifically lima beans, but I did soak beans once in like a black olive juice, and wow. Then I didn't feel like I needed to spice up the stew as much the next day. I mean, I'm sure there was plenty of salt in the black olive juice, but I'm wondering about, like, what if you soaked them in chicken broth or something?
Well, if you do, and you certainly could. The only thing I would warn you of course, and that would be chicken stock has to stay in the refrigerator. And then the other thing you'd have to would change the soaking time is now once you've dropped that temperature to 40 degrees, you've slowed down what's happening during that soaking process. So whether you used apple cider or white wine or a glass of your favorite beer or chicken stock, I would probably, and I can't find anywhere, don't know anyone that's done any of those things. Knock on wood, somebody should be calling in shortly. But I think I would rather add that flavor profile after I've soaked the beans.
Oh, okay.
And how good are these for us?
Well, they're loaded with iron. They're loaded with protein. They're loaded with fiber. They're only 250 calories per cup of cooked beans. They have lots of nutritional characteristics. You know, diabetics love to use them because they lower the amount of glucose that they need. They are known to be a cancer-reducing agent. There's not much said bad about lima beans, or all the beans for that matter.
They're good for you.
These in particular are very good for you.
And sounds like you can get away with very simple preparation.
Well, I talked about one earlier, and that was just soaked in water and finished with, you know, after they're soaked, cook them until they're cooked through, a little more than al dente, salt, pepper, and butter. But I love them in casseroles. I love them in stews. I loved, we talked about earlier, cowboy beans. Lots of preparation recipes with barbecue sauce. They're wonderful with all the smoked pork products, whether they're smoked ham hocks or bacon or anything smoked or cured from a hog. It's pretty good with beans.
I have had red bean ice cream before. Are there sweet applications for the lima bean?
You know, the red bean ice cream that you're referring to is an Asian recipe.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many recipes with honey and other sweetening agents with beans. We just don't do a lot of them in this country. But I'll preface that by saying I have been to an ice cream parlor in New York City. And to give you an idea how off the wall they were, the tables hung from the ceiling, the chairs hung from the ceiling, and all the ice cream flavors were all beans. There was no dairy. And believe me, they had as many flavors as your favorite Ben & Jerry's or Häagen-Dazs or whatever your favorite ice cream is. So there are, yes.
Chef Rosie is bullish on beans. We had a couple of questions for you this week from our listeners.
We had one from Morgan in Moorhead who wants to know, what's the best way to preserve herbs? And I think specifically she wanted to know about basil and cilantro.
You know, the answer I'll give to that is pretty simple. And all of us go through this same challenge, and that is needing some fresh herbs for a recipe. We go to the store, we buy the herbs, we pay the $3, $4. We use it in that one recipe, and needless to say, we almost always have 50 to 75% of the herbs left, and we put it in the kitchen drawer, and then a week later, we find it in the bag, gone. My recommendation is always, always, fresh is always best, but I would use what I needed for that recipe. I would take the rest immediately. I'd put it into my blender. I'd emulsify it with olive oil, puree it, pour it into a Ziploc bag, put it in the freezer, and now, for both now and forevermore, you have fresh frozen basil emulsified in olive oil or cilantro or parsley or whatever herbs you're using. But it's usually a good idea to do it as quickly as possible.
And olive oil.
Olive oil, or what I said olive oil because that's what I use mostly in cooking. But if you're a canola oil lover or whatever oil you like to use is fine.
Because I'm wondering about mint, and I wonder if olive oil wouldn't compete with that
That's a very good example, because if you're using mint in sweet applications, mm-hmm. probably olive oil wouldn't be the best. I'd want to use more of a flavorless oil like safflower.
Okay.
But with that said, I will also tell you that I've had many chocolates filled with olive oil now. It's a very common practice. We're used to chocolates filled with cherries in a box. But now high-end chocolatiers are taking high-end olive oil and emulsifying it, putting it in a chocolate cube. So it does work with olive oil.
Morgan, thanks for the question. If you have a question for Chef Rosie,
send it to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org.
What's happening is next.
You bet your life.
This Sunday afternoon, join us for a return to the golden age of radio, a time from the 1930s through the early 60s, when top-notch actors, writers, and performers were on the radio every night.
For $1,500, tell me, who was our shortest president?
On Prairie Public Presents, this Sunday at 5 Central, we bring you Groucho Marx. Wisecracking is the host of a quiz show.
What is the name of this song?
And then Drama and Terror from Dimension X, a predecessor of shows like The Twilight Zone. And if you like it, maybe we'll do more, so give it a good listen. The Golden Age of Radio, Sunday afternoon at 5 Central on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, Thanksgiving's behind us. Christmas is on its way, so a fair amount's going on that's tied to that holiday season. Ashley Thornburg and I have our What's Happening calendar of events.
And one such event, Christmas on the Prairie, Saturday the 2nd, West Fargo, Bonanzaville. This is a 1900s-era Christmas celebration at Bonanzaville, the pioneer village transformed to a time that featured carolers and people going around and presenting presents to their neighbors, all baked in a wood-burning stove. Of course, you can even design a Christmas card and print it on an old press, go on a horse-drawn wagon ride, and make your own gingerbread house. 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Saturday the 2nd in West Fargo at Bonanzaville. $4 for kids 12 and under and $8 for adults.
Well, the Heritage Christmas Festival will be underway in East Grand Forks on Saturday at Heritage Village. Santa and his reindeer are making a stop at the village in East Grand Forks. Other fun activities include a pancake feed starting at 10 in the morning, and then at 11 there'll be kids singing and crafts and horse-drawn hay rides and a bake sale. It starts at 10 in the morning on Saturday. It ends at 2:30 in the afternoon. Again, it's at the Heritage Village in East Grand Forks. It's free, but they do ask that you kindly bring an item for the food shelf.
All right, here's one called Sensory Santa. This is coming up Friday the 1st in Minot at Caleb's Clubhouse. There are certain kids who aren't equipped to handle big, chaotic, noisy, bright lights environments, and so this is an event for them. They have lower lights, a quiet environment, softer music, even a therapy dog for anyone who maybe doesn't want to sit with Santa without a little bit of help of a great puppy there. This is going on Friday, December 1st in Minot. Why not at Caleb's Clubhouse, 3:30 to 5:30 p.m., and it's free.
Well, here's a wonderful performer. Chuck Suki is Saturday in Fargo at the Spirit Room. Singer, songwriter, farmer Chuck Suki will perform his special original songs and stories at Fargo's Spirit Room. That's downtown Broadway. Suki's been heralded as one of the great American songwriters by Rod Kennedy, founder of the Kerrville, Texas Folk Festival. That's the premier songwriting festival in the country. Suki raises grass-fed beef on the farm he grew up on near Mandan, North Dakota. When he's not singing, he's the recipient of the 2015 Governor's Award for the Arts. This will be 7 o'clock on Saturday. Again, it's downtown in Fargo at the Spirit Room on Broadway. It costs $12.
There's going to be a pop art class Wednesday, December 6th in Jamestown at the Arts Center. Be inspired by the bold art of Roy Lichtenstein, and you can imitate that unique look. They're going to be doing that with bubble wrap and learning different printmaking techniques. Intro level and all materials are provided 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Wednesday, December 6th in Jamestown at the Arts Center. If you are a member of the Arts Center, the class is $15. Otherwise, it is $25.
The Whoever Can Come Band Jam Session is Saturday in Valley City at the Barnes County Museum. It's open to all. The jam session at the Barnes County Museum is a monthly event. You can just bring an instrument and play along. They want you to jam with them. It starts at 1 in the afternoon. It goes until 4, and it's free. Again, at the Barnes County Museum in Valley City.
Author and historian for the Montana Historical Press, Ellen Baumler, is going to be presenting Profiles of African American Montanans. This is actually tonight in Sidney, Montana at the Mondak Heritage Center at 7 o'clock Mountain Time. And though she says, though African Americans are small in numbers in Montana, they nevertheless have a rich and varied history in the state that is largely unexplored. And she is aiming to fix that by chronicling the lives and contributions of more than 20 African-American families and individuals with photographs, headlines, art, architecture, and so much more. Again, the class is at 7 o'clock Mountain Time at the Mondak Heritage Center in Sydney, and it's free.
Well, here's a sign of the season. Handel's Messiah is Friday and Saturday in Fargo at the First Lutheran Church, conducted by Dr. Joanne Miller, Baroque Festival Music Director. Over 200 students in five choirs and the Baroque Festival Orchestra will present and Handel's monumental piece, which has become a holiday tradition throughout the world. It's 7:30, again, Friday and Saturday, at the First Lutheran Church in downtown Fargo. It costs from $10 to $20.
All right, another sign of the season. And my pick of the week is the Dickens Christmas Village Festival this Friday and Saturday in Garrison, all along Main Street. They're transforming themselves into the Christmas capital of North Dakota, and they try to do this in a Victorian way. So they have a quaint English setting with craft vendors, a lighted parade, street food vendors, daily entertainment and tours. And of course, you can take in a showing of A Christmas Carol and go back to the day of Charles Dickens. Guests are even encouraged, get this, to hitch a ride on the Queen Elizabeth, an authentic bus straight from England, and you can partake in many festivities there. 2 o'clock on Friday and Saturday, the 2nd in Garrison. That would be sort of the time of the parade, but events throughout the day, and most of them are free.
Well, I encourage people to go to Handel's Messiah in Minot on Sunday at Minot States and Nicole Nelson Hall. Their Messiah has been a fixture of the Minot holiday season for over 100 years. It's been performed continuously since 1929. And for this performance, the Heritage Singers, Voices of Note, and various community members will join Minot State University's concert choir. It's 3 in the afternoon on Sunday, and it's free and open to the public. And my choice is It's a Wonderful Life, a live radio play, which opens tonight, runs through Saturday, and then is again next weekend from Thursday through Saturday with a Sunday matinee. It's in Bismarck at Dakota Stage, filled with nostalgia and charm. Audiences will step back in time to the golden age of radio with this funny and unique retelling that may just leave you believing in angels. Of course, It's a Wonderful Life was a famous movie with Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed, and this is a radio show retelling of it. It costs $22 for general admission for seniors and students and military personnel. It's $19 on stage in Bismarck at Dakota Stage. And that's what's happening.
Listen to our podcast or a previous broadcast anytime, anywhere. In your home or on your phone, you can catch Main Street on any street. All day, all night, a friend in Fiji or your aunt in Vermont can tune into a show you just know they'd want to hear, or they can browse older shows for other topics of interest. Our app and archives are easy to find. They're right on Main Street in the radio neighborhood at prairiepublic.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 30th. If you've ever been around the Fort Berthold Reservation, you may have driven across the Four Bears Bridge, although you are probably not aware of its long and rich history. It began with the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara tribes. Since the 15th century, they lived in the river bottomland. When the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation was created in 1851, they became the three affiliated tribes and received a small portion of those lands to live on. In 1934, they decided to build a bridge to cross the Missouri River at the now underwater town of Elba Woods. They dedicated the northern half to a Hidatsa chief and the southern half to a Mandan chief, both of whom were named Forebears, and thus the bridge received its name. Severe floods swept the lower Missouri River Basin in 1943. In response, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers started surveying to plan a flood control dam. From 1945 to 1954, they constructed the dam. Many tribes and white settlers migrated as a result because the project took 155,000 acres, or about 25% of reservation land. The bridge also moved, getting dismantled with portions reused 70 miles upstream at Newtown, the second Four Bears Bridge. Unfortunately, by the 1990s, the 20-foot-wide roadway was too narrow and was deemed unsafe. The state began to conduct studies in 1993 to evaluate ways to improve the bridge, and they decided they would replace the bridge with one that integrated designs from the three affiliated tribes. They began construction in April of 2003. Unfortunately, on this date, in 2004, when the bridge was 65% complete, a portion of it collapsed, killing one of the workers and injuring three others. The bridge was finally finished in September of 2005, complete with tribal medallions, markers, and storyboards with the history of the three tribes. So, if you're ever by the Fort Berthold Reservation and Newtown, North Dakota, stop by the Four Bears Bridge for a history lesson. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
When writing his new film, Guillermo del Toro found that sometimes it's the quiet ones who say the most.
Every single character that has the power of speech has problems communicating. And the two characters that have not the power of speech, they are actually communicating beautifully.
His latest fairy tale is called The Shape of Water. Plus, we'll hear the latest on the Republican tax overhaul. That's all in the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
On Friday, we'll hold our monthly Editor's Roundtable with News Director Dave Thompson and special guest Christopher Bierke, Grand Forks Herald News Editor, and Tony Bender, who's with several Central North Dakota papers, including the Ashley Tribune and Wishing Star. And Matt Olin will review the new movie, The Florida Project. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.